you aren't following your highest good. Allow yourself the ability to expand and grow by thinking and feeling beyond what your current dogma allows. 4. The ultimate path to happiness is non-attachment. And before you get all caught up in the impossibility of not caring about the outcome of your life, understand that non-attachment is much more, and yet much simpler, than not caring how things turn out. It's about the simple understanding that all things serve you. The bad things teach you and show you how to heal to open even further to the good things. It cannot be put much simpler than that. 5. Doing is not as important as simply being. Meditative states can be achieved through a variety of practices, but perhaps the most underutilized among them is just sitting. The art of doing nothing is profound. It quiets the waters of your mind, brings forth what needs to be immediately acknowledged and healed, and keeps you connected to yourself, not the attachments and responsibilities you have in your life. The point is, you are not what you do. You simply are. Aside from a meditation practice, giving yourself the time to relax, recuperate, and reflect is of the utmost importance. 6. You can be an objective observer of your mind and your life. It's one thing to know that you can choose your thoughts, but it's really more to realize that you can also decide which ones you value, if only you are able to see them all objectively. Guided meditation practices will often have you observe thoughts as they pass, as a third-party viewer, the point being to teach you that you are not those thoughts. You are not your feelings. You are the being that experiences those thoughts and feelings, who decides which to value and act on. 7. Your natural state is oneness. The reality we will all return to eventually is that everything is one. This is the basis of enlightenment. It is in the illusion of separateness that we suffer. It is playing out the ideas of individualism that we learn. It is to our natural state, unification, that we eventually return. 94. Six signs you have a healthy social sensitivity. In a world that seems to assume that extroversion is the norm, and introverts exist within a counterculture that needs to be justified and explained at every step and turn, it seems we've begun to overthink what a normal, healthy amount of social sensitivity is. Not liking everybody, or desiring solitude, or preferring one close friend to a group of many is not social dysfunction. We're overgeneralizing what it means to be antisocial or socially anxious, when those are extreme, if not clinical terms that we may want to think twice before throwing around. Here, a few ways to determine whether or not your social sensitivity is normal. 1. You experience a degree of social anxiety in unfamiliar situations. Social anxiety is usually having enough foresight to recognize what people may be judging or assuming about you. If not kept in check, it can paralyze rather than keep you self-aware. It is normal, if not indicative, of a high intelligence. 2. You desire solitude because being alone is emotionally enriching. You do not isolate yourself when you'd prefer to be with others, simply because you're afraid of feeling unworthy of keeping company. 3. You only enjoy the company of a few select people. You're not supposed to like everybody. To say that you like everybody would be to deny and reject the parts of you that may not genuinely feel that way. And as we all know, disassociation isn't good. We're only meant to really love and enjoy a few people and tolerate a few more. 4. You say no to plans when you want to say no to plans. You do not go because you feel obligated or pressured. You are able to say no to people who you don't want to see, and to doing things you don't really want to do, when the cost would be your mental or emotional well-being. 5. You analyze situations because your snap judgments may not be well-informed, not because you'd like to reinforce your anxiety or make yourself feel better through delusion. You self-evaluate as a means of becoming aware of what may perhaps be unconscious choices and habits. You do not over-evaluate with the intention of arriving at a different, made-up conclusion, or to create an alternative perspective that supports an irrational idea. He looked at me funny. I knew he hated me. 6. You worry that your social anxiety is abnormal. Worrying about whether or not you have too much anxiety about being in social situations is probably the most normal thing there is. That's not a product of having a severe problem. It's a product of wanting to be self-aware enough to handle it if there is. 95. Now is all you have. From all the time I spend overanalyzing, an arbitrary act I can't be the only one guilty of, I realize that I'm able to routinely trace all of my issues back to the same core problem. I don't know how to be uncomfortable. I don't know how to be able to feel the good things without being completely deterred from the experience by the inevitably bad. It's something I have to outgrow, because it's certainly not something that is resolvable. It's just life. And I think we live in a world that's all but curated that mindset for us. I have the issue of seeing parts of my life as just precursors of time to facilitate getting to where I want to be next. And the sickening reality of that is, given enough of those days, your entire life becomes a waiting game. Now, I've been able to resolve a lot of that nagging, lingering need to escape. But of course, it creeps up on me now and again. So I can't help but be interested in it. Because it comes from the idea that there will be a happily ever after. You get through the pain, and then you bask in having been healed and reconciled and changed, and made once again whole and new. But there is no swift motion of starting in darkness and moving toward the light indefinitely. There's a lot of in and out. There's a lot of gray area. There are days you're so far back you can't believe you let yourself get there. And then there are days you forget that you were ever miserable to begin with. Getting stunted by this, being fearful of moving forward and more fearful of going back, is the only guaranteed way that it will ruin you. Because it's a succession of nows that will add up, lifting us from awareness of one experience to another, that will be all we have in the end. So what we see in the experience is what we have to appreciate before we're lifted away from the monotonous routine, because the alternative is that we cease to exist. We're done. And we let things pass because the discomfort made us feel like we were backtracking away from that light state we're perpetually moving toward. We made a bad life out of a few bad experiences, because we weren't able to check off the list of things we had in our minds as prerequisites for feeling content, dare I even say, happy. But happiness isn't a contrived mental process that you allow yourself in when things are thought to be right. It's an experience. It is an emotion. And all you have is right now to experience it. And I see such patterns of thinking facilitated largely by our society. Not only that there will be a happily ever after that we are all entitled to after we've suffered enough, but that joy is in planning for tomorrow. To be very, well, millennial about it, God, I can't believe I'm using this as an example, it's like the Tumblr posts and Pinterest boards that are all images of what we want, hope for, and are inspired by. And it's lovely to look at those beautiful things and decide you want them. But how many of us actually get up and get them? Even something as simple as a pretty coffee and a book to read by a windowsill. Not many. We get up to complain about not having the lives we dream of and carry on, day after day, rinse and repeat. Now is all we have, my friends. You have to choose now. You have to live in the heartbreaking reality that is what you see and perceive in this moment. The mess. The beautiful schisms that make for wars and love and peacemaking and harmony and change. The rawness of being so low some days that all you can muster up as your purpose is just to keep breathing. And then realize that's all there is either way. Maybe it is about diving into the deep end and letting now be more than just enough. Realizing that things are only ever as boring and mundane as we let them be. That there are mysteries and experiences and fascinatingly foreign parts of life that we won't see until we take a step out on the wild side. The side of us that isn't concerned about tomorrow. 96. The Art of Mindlessness. Many people have written beautiful pieces about the importance and their experience with mindfulness. The ancient practice and supposed modern anecdote to our perpetual dissatisfaction. Live in the moment. Be conscious of every sensation of your daily experience. This kind of awareness, in my opinion, is more than just a proposed solution to our human condition. It's the final frontier. It's the place we will all find ourselves at one point or another, either embracing each moment as it comes, or letting them all wash by us, mindlessly. So when I say that what we really have to work on is mindlessness, I by no means am actually talking about not being mindful. It's just a play on the phrase. I wanted to clarify in case there was any confusion. We talk about the importance of mindfulness in the context of being conscious and present, completely immersed in our experience. That is crucial. But what is also crucial is realizing that much of that has to do with how we can transcend the mind. We live in a culture and a period of human existence that is far too concerned with what we think about things. Though reason is crucial to our development, it sometimes denies our instincts, desires, and pleasures in place of expectation and normalcy. We can't be surprised that when we try to confine the fluid, natural, untamable reality of a human soul, that we end up suffering as we do. We are a species disconnected. For all the technological advancements we've made, our ability to connect on a human level is miles away from its natural primitive state. Our daily discussions are so deeply imbued with value placed on man-made means. We are focused so much on what man can do and not nearly enough on what man is. We are steadily moving away from concepts of religion, associating faith and trust with ignorance as opposed to spiritual intelligence. We simply don't value the reality of our human existence, the part of us that is up for interpretation, partially because it's unknown, and mostly because we can't agree on anything or know for certain, so we deny it, rather than embrace its unknownness. What we think, we become. And if what we are becoming is any indication, we are thinking far too much about the things that don't matter, and not making room for uncertainty, for discomfort, for the things that are indeed unknown but which yield the best outcomes, the ones that are indeed larger than our mind's comprehension. In our incessant mindfulness, not in the meditative way but just in the fact that we process everything psychologically, we start labeling, categorizing, and defining things. We become used to what's known and disregard what isn't. This doesn't leave room for the acceptance of people and things that aren't like us. We relinquish responsibility by putting other people beneath us. We declare their sentiments wrong and unjust, and therefore we are superior. We live in a culture that makes means and commodity out of ripping each other apart, and it functions healthfully because we buy into it. We love to see how other people aren't as good as we are. how we can place them beneath us and find comfort in the knowing that we are okay because we are better than them. But we end up caging ourselves. We inevitably fall within what we once said was wrong, because we're human beings, and dangerous territory is the mind that doesn't leave room for the soul to falter. We need to teach our children not to have screaming fits because it makes us look bad as caretakers, but because learning to process negative emotions without being scolded and shamed for them is important. We need to become actively, consciously aware of what we are buying, clicking, associating with, and inevitably supporting, especially when it serves to do nothing but harm another person, even if we don't realize it at the time. We have to stop defining people. We have to take our discomfort with the unknown and settle into it firmly, because the fact that we will be uncertain is a certainty. We have to realize that major change can only happen on a minor scale, one individual at a time. We have to move on from our minds and move into our hearts. What makes us the same is something our minds may never be able to understand. We have to let go of trying to understand everything else that's collateral to suffice for it. 97. The difference between how you feel and how you think you feel. Imagine the last time you had a strong emotional response to something. Was it the product of having sat with the experience for a moment, processing and internalizing it, and then scanning your body to determine how you felt? Probably not. When we ask one another, "How do you feel about that?" it's essentially interchangeable with, "What do you think about that?" Emotions are simple and subtle. When we scan our bodies, we find that they are sensations, and ultimately they boil down to one of two things, tightness or openness. It's how we interpret that tension or ease that we create thoughts that then exacerbate intense, joyous, debilitating, any extreme, emotions. This is to say, we create the way we think we feel simply by assigning meaning to sensations. There is a difference between how we feel and how we think we should feel. This is the reason for everything from mob mentality to social conditioning. It's also largely why people feel stuck in inescapable emotional turmoil. No emotion lasts for any significant period of time. That's not how they're designed. It's only the cognitive patterning that keeps us re-inciting a feeling over and over again, or that keeps us from choosing the course of action that the emotion is guiding us toward. We are taught how we should feel about roughly everything in life. Our cultural, religious, familial upbringings dictate a set of things that are good and bad. Our egos, our desires for survival, superiority, love, acceptance, etc., fill in the rest. We end up with a mental ecosystem of actions and reactions. These mental emotions, as I call them, are by and large the reason we suffer, despite being more evolved than ever before. It is no longer our fleeting sense of hunger or desire to mate that controls us. It's our thoughts about what it means when someone doesn't love us, and how our subconscious minds seek confirmation that this is true, and how this repetitiveness creates a belief, and how that belief creates our lives. We're taught that either which way you go, a life worth living is one that is highly emotional. It's full of love, or full of passion, or one in which you persevere through incredible suffering. We believe we should have an opinion on things to know who we are, and worse, we believe we should have an emotional response to feel as though our voices are counted. This is what makes us feel worthwhile. This is what makes life feel worthwhile. The next time you feel like you're in an inescapable circumstance, honestly scan your body and see what's present. Even a tightness or uneasy feeling in your gut is just that, a little bit of stress. That's it. That is all. That is all that feeling can do to you. check back in after an hour, after a day. It will probably be gone. What you'll realize is that even your gut feelings, your instincts, are not overpowering huge emotional waves. That's why it's called the little voice within. Sometimes we aren't comfortable with the inherent quietness within us, and so we create layers of chaos to distract ourselves from it. But once that chaos becomes exhausting, all you have to do is sit back with yourself and just let yourself feel what you feel, not what you think you feel. What you'll realize is that even when your emotions are telling you the worst, this is not right, you need to change, the manner in which you inherently communicate with yourself is always soft. It's always gentle. It's always loving. And it's always trying to help you. What you'll also realize is that you don't have a natural aversion to your emotions. They aren't bad. They don't feel bad, even though your brain wasn't taught to label them as good. We enjoy sadness and pain and everything else at the appropriate time, to the appropriate extent. We enjoy it because it is an aspect of simply allowing our emotions to be. It's not our thoughts that create our lives. It's how we use our thoughts to dissect the meaning of our emotions, and how, based on our assertions, we decide what's good, bad, right, and wrong. None of these things inherently exist. The symphony that results from our orchestration of them is what creates our perception of whether or not we're living a good life. 98. The power of negative thinking. If you want to be emotionally free, there's only one thing you need to understand. Whatever problem you think you have right now is not the actual problem. The problem is that you do not know how to think about your problem correctly. You're sick of platitudes, but this isn't really something you can afford to ignore. This isn't just advice that may perhaps be applicable to some people, sometimes, in certain situations. It is not just a kind notion that can soothe you on a hard day. It's not just something you can lean on when you've exhausted all other options. The point of experiencing anything is learning how to think about it differently. When you do not do the work of learning to think differently, you become stuck. The more we experience, the more capable we are of seeing the world with varied lenses, thinking with more dimension, considering possibilities that were previously inconceivable. Real education is not learning what to think about, but how to think in general. Learning how to better ignore negative thoughts is not learning how to think. It's learning how to disassociate. Our negative thoughts inform us as much as positive ones do. Rather than becoming afraid, we can learn to see them as directives, or at the very least, if we can be discerning about what we ascribe meaning to, we can decide what matters to us and to what degree. Therein is the power of negative thinking. As the Stoics practiced negative visualization, imagining the worst possible outcomes and then preparing for them, learning how to think is a simple art of recognizing that you choose how you apply meaning and emotion to your life. And if you don't consciously decide what matters and what doesn't, you'll spend the rest of your life in feeling patterns, responding to what you're conditioned by when you were young. The solution is not a hyper-focus on positivity, as mainstream pop psych would have you believe, but learning how to turn the shadow aspects of your mind into forces that ignite change and inspire growth. Emotional freedom and inner peace come from knowing what to do when those negative thoughts and feelings arise, because they will. As Jonah Lehrer explains, we regulate our emotions by thinking about them. Our prefrontal cortexes allow us to think about our own minds. Our brains think about themselves. Psychologists call it metacognition. We know when we are angry because each feeling state must come with a degree of self-awareness, so we can figure out why we're feeling what we're feeling. Without that awareness, we wouldn't know we are afraid of the lion that's charging at us in the wild, so we wouldn't run to escape it. If we didn't run away, what would be the point of the feeling in the first place? But more importantly, if a feeling doesn't make sense, if the amygdala is responding to a loss frame, then it can be ignored. The prefrontal cortex can deliberately choose to ignore the emotional brain, that is, if it determines there is no merit in ascribing meaning. What this means is that whatever problem you think you have in your life is not the problem. It's the fact that you see it as a problem, rather than a signal you refuse to respond to, or a product of over-ascribing meaning, extrapolation, irrational thoughts that created irrational emotions that continue to go unchecked, and so on. It is the fact that you see the problem as a problem, rather than a fallacy in your understanding, your focus, your perception. The problem is not the problem. It is how you think about the problem. If you want to function, you have to learn how to think about your feelings. The difference between the kind of anxiety that paralyzes you and the kind of fear that accompanies anything brave and worthwhile is discernment, which takes practice. The difference between the kind of people who turn their obstacles into opportunities and the kind of people who are crushed beneath the weight of their own uncertainty is knowledge and awareness. Being uncomfortable forces us to think of options that we wouldn't have had to imagine before. It is why heartbreak is crucial to human growth, the obstacle that becomes the way. Any idiot can enjoy the positive things in their lives, but it is only a few that can take the negative and find something even more profound. 99. What you need to do to heal your life from anxiety. 1. The opposite of addiction isn't sobriety, it's connection. The same is true for anxiety. Anxiety is being disconnected from the present moment, other people, or yourself. Usually all three. You must reconnect with your life. 2. You must give yourself permission to want what you really want. There is no way around this. Whether it's a romantic partner, a better job, some more money, recognition for your work, see it and accept it. Even if you think society says it means you're shallow or broken or don't love yourself enough. 3. If you can't figure out what you really want, look straight at your deepest fears. What's on the other side of them? That's what you want. 4. Be grateful for your discomfort. The sad and weird thing is that happy people are complacent. Feeling uncomfortable is the signal that you're on the precipice of something new and better, but you must take action. 5. Your new best friends will be structure and productivity. It's not about checking off a 100-point task list. It's about knowing that you accomplish something, anything, that contributes to your well-being each day. 6. Irrational anxiety is usually cured by doing very practical things. The nonsensical things you worry about are usually aggrandized projections of real concerns that you're not dealing with. 7. You must start where you are, you must use what you have, and you must do what you can. Anything else is running away from your problems and abandoning your life and yourself. Real change is a product of evolution. Thinking otherwise is an illusion that will keep you separated from the very stuff you need to heal. 8. Make a conscious effort to connect and reconnect with the people you already have in your life, even if it's just one person you trust and connect with. This will begin to reform healthy emotional attachments. It's not weak to need love. 9. Buy a notebook that is exclusively for junk journaling, which is what you're going to do whenever you feel pretzeled up inside. Write down whatever comes out. Whatever gruesome, awful, self-hating, embarrassing thoughts come up, let them out. Once you do this a few times, you'll believe me when I say this will release them. 10. The only thing you should ever try to do when you're very anxious or panicked is to comfort yourself. You cannot think clearly and shouldn't make assumptions or decisions about your life in that state. Figure out what soothes you. A snack, a bath, talking to someone, doing something you really enjoy, and get yourself out of that energy before you do anything else. 11. You will need to figure out how to live in the moment, even if that seems boring, impossible, terrifying, or all three. Anxiety is a warning sign that we're too much in the past or the future, and being there is affecting how we make choices in the present. 12. You will need to take action on the things that are holding you back from pursuing the things you actually want. As Cheryl Strayed says, real change happens on the level of the gesture. It's one person doing one thing differently than they did before. 13. Read. If you don't read, it's not because you don't like reading. It's because you haven't picked up anything that interests you. What you read now will affect the person you're going to be for decades to come. Read articles and essays online about how people cope with their fears. In it, you will find camaraderie, how many strangers feel just as you do. Read about things you don't understand, that scare you and fascinate you. Just read, damn it. 14. You can change how you feel. This is something you must remember. It's as simple as, I want to feel differently about this, so I am going to focus on a different aspect of it. 15. If you want to buy into the idea that you cannot choose happiness, or how you feel, or what you think, you are condemning yourself to an extremely hard life and should stop listening now, because doing those things is the only way to save yourself. 16. You will always have anxiety. You will always feel fear. If you give a damn about your life, or if you're even paying the slightest bit of attention to what's going on here, you'll know there's a lot to be anxious and afraid of. The end goal is not to eliminate those feelings, but to strengthen the mental muscle that will allow you to choose to be happy in spite of them, not become paralyzed when they're present. That's all. 17. For some people, strengthening that muscle will require a simple shift of perspective. For others, it will be years of medication and therapy and more work and effort than they've ever put into anything before. It is the fight of all our lives and the thing we most owe to ourselves. If you're going to pick a battle, pick this one. 18. The problem is not the problem. The problem is how you think about the problem. Your internal guidance system is sounding off right now because something isn't right. This doesn't mean you're barreling toward a life of perpetual, inescapable suffering. It means somewhere deep down you know there's another way, a better way to live. It means you know what you want, even if you're scared of it. 19. You need to choose love. This sounds like annoying advice, but you cannot give up on the people who light you up inside, on the things you love to do, even if they aren't work, on what you want for yourself. You must choose love, even if it scares you. In fact, your fear about doing something is proportionate to your love for it. 20. You must learn how to express pain when you feel it. This does not mean you can justify reckless, unchecked behavior. It means you need to learn how to acknowledge your pain, communicate it clearly to others, and deal with it as it comes up. 21. You must learn how to unravel whatever emotional toxicity is built up inside you. For example, if you don't let yourself feel and accept that you are hurt badly by your ex, you will constantly be projecting ideas about how your new fling will hurt you and how you shouldn't even try, thus recreating the situation you're most afraid of. The unraveling is seeing, feeling, and accepting. Life is sometimes brutal and unfair and unspeakably horrendous. We are all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. Oscar Wilde. 22. Separate sensations in your body from what you think they mean. When you're seriously upset, ask yourself, what do I actually feel in my body right now? Like, what do I actually feel? Chances are it's nothing more than just a little tension or discomfort. The rest of your panic is everything you've chalked that sensation up to mean. 23. Don't trust all of your feelings. Conventional wisdom says to, but that's insane, considering how many of those feelings stem from irrational thoughts and past experiences and so on. If you blindly trust all of your feelings, you will be thrown around by them constantly. Decide which ones mean something and which don't. 24. Utilize the most powerful growing tool of all, future self-work. If you're on the fence about kids, imagine your life at 75. Do you want your own family around you, or are you okay on your own? Imagine your life in 3 years from now. Will you be happy you didn't try harder in that relationship, or that you didn't save any money, or that you wasted your time watching Netflix when you could have been writing the book or starting the business, or playing music like you really want to? Imagine your life from the perspective of the person you hope to be. It will place many things back into alignment. 100. Stop chasing happiness. Alan Watts taught that the desire for security and the feeling of insecurity are one and the same, that to hold your breath is to lose your breath. Traditional Zen Buddhism would agree. To desire fulfillment is to not have fulfillment. Happiness is not something you seek, but that which you become. These ideas are nice, albeit likely just platitudes for most people, but they illustrate the madness behind the common wisdom of chasing happiness. As Andrew Weil has said, the idea that human beings should be constantly happy is a uniquely modern, uniquely American, uniquely destructive idea. It is our desire for perpetual happiness that drives consumerism, eases the fact that we're all barreling toward uncertain death, and keeps us hungering for more. In many ways, it, alongside our existential fear of death and suffering, accounts for why we've innovated and developed the society we live in. Our lack of fulfillment has driven us because the quest for happiness does not and will not cease. This is largely due to hedonic adaptation, which is really just the fact that human beings get used to what happens to them. We change, we adjust, we adapt, we crave more. Psychologists also call it the baseline, the way in which we regulate ourselves to come back to neutral after different life events occur. Chasing happiness is trying to keep ourselves sustained by positive life events, rather than adjusting the baseline as a whole. Motivating ourselves with the hope of achieving a sustained feeling of good is not only unhealthy, it's impossible. If you want to be happy, you need to stop chasing happiness. Happiness is a byproduct of doing things that are challenging, meaningful, beautiful, and worthwhile. It is wiser to spend a life chasing knowledge, or the ability to think clearly and with more dimension, than it is to just chase what feels good. It is wiser to chase the kind of discomfort that only comes with doing something so profound and life-altering that you are knocked off your orbit. It is wiser to tip the scales over, rather than balance things you don't like only because you believe balance will make you happy. It is wiser to do things that are hard and make you feel vulnerable and raw than it is to avoid them because comfort makes you feel temporarily, fleetingly good. At the end of the day, to avoid pain is to avoid happiness. They are opposite forces within the same function. To numb ourselves to one side of our feeling capacity is to shut down everything. It leaves us chasing the kind of empty happiness that never really fills us and leaves us shells of the people we are really destined to be. 101. What you should know if you're experiencing metanoia, a change of mind, heart, self, or way of life. Whether it's a simple shift of committing to treating people with more kindness, the brutal and liberating realization that you're responsible for your own happiness, trying to better make sense of the world is a heavy-duty task, and we're called to do it numerous times in a life. There's a beautiful word for this. It's called metanoia, and it originates from the Greek word for changing one's mind or purpose. It really doesn't matter what you're changing from or to, only that any kind of massive psychological or emotional shift tends to heed similar circumstances and common struggles. Here are a few things you need to know if you're going through one of your own. 1. If it's a relationship that prompted a revolution in your worldview, know that this relationship has likely served its purpose. A lot of people hold on to the catalyst of their personal awakenings because they confuse big love for being forever love. They're not the same thing. 2. You don't need to be mad about your limiting old beliefs. Change is in building what's next, not in dismantling what was. You don't need to ruminate in disappointment for how long you spent not realizing there was more to life than you assumed. The point is that you figured it out eventually. 3. The base of any personal catastrophe or desire for deeper understanding is usually the same. It's the realization that you, and only you, are responsible for your life. You cannot depend on anything, to do the real grueling work of what it means to find comfort in a world that's entirely impermanent. No job, no amount of money, no relationship, no accomplishment can supplement that for you. It's a peace you must come to first. Then you can enjoy the rest. 4. Loving yourself is an action, not a feeling. When we think of romantic love, we think of the flush of hormones that gives us an ooey-gooey emotion. We rarely think of the daily tasks and commitments necessary to make someone else's well-being as important as our own. The same goes for loving yourself. We think it's the emotion that comes with holding yourself in high regard, when most of the time it's more like standing up for yourself, having the courage to keep going, having the courage to quit, finding happiness despite the impermanence and unreliability of things, and so on. 5. You don't need to have every answer, nor will you ever have every answer. It's never about how certain you are. It's about how willing you are to try anyway. Nobody knows the mysterious abyss from which we come and eventually go back to. And yet so many people's lives, and our society slash culture in general, are crafted and dictated from teachings about this unknown. Everything is speculation for now, but some speculations lead to a happier, kinder, more peaceful world, and some don't. The point isn't who knows what for sure. The point is who is willing to do what it takes to make the best version of the reality we have now. 6. You don't need to believe in anything, but you do need to be able to listen to what feels true in the moment and hold enough objectivity to speak and act with respect and kindness toward yourself and those around you. And if you're instructed or pressured to believe in anything that doesn't resonate with you at basically every cell of your being, know that it is your internal guidance system saying, "Not quite." 7. Your struggles will be what make you what you are. Discomfort is a pressure usually required to make us act in a way that we wouldn't otherwise. This, on the surface, feels scary, because it is unknown. But the most difficult moments of your life will be the catalysts of your becoming. The challenges will grow you into someone you never imagined you could be. The bad things in your life will be the necessary leeways into things better than you can imagine. You will be grateful things didn't turn out the way you wanted. You will be grateful for what you struggle with once you get to the other side. This concludes 101 Essays That Will Change the Way You Think by Brianna Weist. Narrated by Abby Craden. Copyright 2016 by Brianna Weist. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Thought Catalog Books and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.